I'm going to stop there and invite questions. Again, there are many other aspects of sexuality we could have touched on and discussed. So I welcome questions on marital sexuality, single sexuality, how married and single people are supposed to be in this together, whether it seems weird and uncomfortable to imagine married and single people being in this together. I have to say, while questions are coming up, I find that this community point, this idea that these are supposed to be community issues, is complicated. Oh, pass your questions to the person on the end of your pew. I've been instructed to instruct you. And as a practical matter, I am so grateful when people of different ages and stations, and in particular when married and single people, come together in real community in the church life. And part of the reason that I'm grateful is that as someone whose parents were divorced, I don't have any real great pictures of marriage. I mean, I have Hollywood's pictures, which aren't that wonderful. Then I have my parents' picture, which wasn't that great. And it's really only been through getting invited pretty deeply into other Christians' homes that I've been able to see marriage modeled well. And then I have to say, Griff and I tried to make, we sort of made these pledges. We said, like, oh, when we get married, we're not going to be those Christians who get married and turn into people who don't have single friends anymore, like all of our friends who got married and abandoned us. And we were stunned by the intensity of the sort of tacit social pressure to do that. The sort of tacit social pressure, at least in our church communities, to, have only married people socializing with one another. So we have a little rule at our house that we try to only have odd numbers of chairs at our dinner parties. That we're not only just having married people. All right.
Got some. Don't you love that her husband's named Griff? Don't you like that?
I know, it sounds like he's sort of a character in a novel.
Come sit down here.
Griff Gaywood, I'm going to grab my water. But it really is his name. I know a memoirist in North Carolina, actually, who wrote this whole memoir about her husband and her kids, and it was one of these I Hate Being a Mother memoirs, of which there seemed to be a small cottage industry. And she had a note in the memoir at the beginning where she said, like, to protect people's privacy, I've changed their names, which is very common. I changed some people's names, as obviously, my books. But it didn't occur to me that she changed her husband's name, because really, what would be the point? I mean, if you knew her, then you would know who her husband was, and if you didn't know her, it wouldn't matter. And then I, being the nerd that I am, I always read, and I often read them first, the acknowledgement pages in books. I love reading acknowledgements pages. And I figured out that although she had, in fact, changed the name of her husband in the text of the book, she thanked him by his real name in the acknowledgments. So you had to wonder really how much work it did for her to give him that pseudonym. But
okay, Lauren, they're saying scoot up a little bit.
If you would. I'm working on it. It's working. Okay. Great. Right.
Thank you. Okay, we've got some good questions here. First, how do you feel about counseling teenagers about sex, birth control, safe sex, et cetera, since statistics show some will have sex? What do you say to a couple who are... Oh, that's another one. Let me just stop there.
Well, I think that's a really important question for the church. And at risk of saying something that I know some folks are going to disagree with, I have some discomfort with abstinence-only education. Precisely because... among other things, we're dealing with potentially deathly diseases. And I just get very nervous about the idea that if we're going to be doing some kind of sex education with teenagers, I just think there ought to be some discussion of how to avoid getting those diseases. Now, let me be clear. I don't think any teaching on sex begins or ends with a kind of negative scare tactic about a disease. But I do think that's something that people need to be educated about. And that when done in the context of church, family, community, et cetera, I think one can teach that information and still be teaching, obviously, the larger Christian story. I mean, it's interesting, studies on sex at Christian campuses, which all clearly show that unmarried college students at evangelical campuses are, in fact, some of them having sex. One study found that the rate of having unprotected sex among sexually active students is much higher at Christian campuses than at secular campuses. And I think that that's in part because there is this notion that many of us unmarried Christian, I know I certainly carried this around as an unmarried Christian, have this idea that, well, if I'm using birth control, that suggests that I planned it, and somehow the sin is less serious if I just got like swept away in the moment, even if I'm getting swept away daily for 2 years in this relationship with the same person, right? You know, and frankly, that's dangerous and stupid. I mean, preferably one wouldn't be having sex, but one hopefully is not going to get an STD while doing it. The other statistics on unprotected sex and STDs that I've read recently are about the state of Florida, that in retirement communities, there's a lot more sex happening than a lot of us might have thought, and that for similar reasons of, to some extent, maybe some lack of education, because that's still a generation of people who, you know, weren't kind of brainwashed as I was by kind of HIV stuff, but also, again, a sort of social pressure that, like, huh, is this person supposed to be thinking about having sex? Anyway, this is a digression. That's not about teenagers. But I do think that educating Christian teenagers about sexuality requires, among other things, some medical information, and that we ought not be afraid of imparting that medical information. You know, if that's the only thing we're teaching teenagers, then that wouldn't make sense either. But it does seem to me that until we can somehow create a world where the statistics don't tell us that a lot of Christians have extramarital sex, that we do need to help people get accurate information, because they're going to, you know, then just Google it or something.
Well, this relates in some ways. What encouragement, tips, strategies do you have for singles who practicing chastity, want to practice chastity, but find it extremely difficult? And then you mentioned something about community in your book, and you mentioned it tonight.
Well, we could spend a whole hour sort of on the question of the practicalities of being single and practicing chastity and the struggles that entails. I find that when people ask this question, they may be asking a variety of things. They may be asking about masturbation, the sort of in a euphemistic roundabout way. They may be asking a question designed to elicit the answer, oh, just take a bubble bath and, you know, drink a glass of your favorite beverage while doing that, and you'll have a sensual experience. Which seems to me odd advice. Like, I like bubble baths as much as the next girl, but they're not sex, and they're not going to be sex. I was once told, allow one of your girlfriends to braid your hair. That will be a kind of sensual encounter, which is a confusing, among other things. It's a confusion of the sensual with the sexual. It is true that we live in a culture where almost all touch has gotten sexualized in a way that's really unfortunate. I think men have that problem. You know, it's okay if two women hug. We have even more weirdness about men having kind of platonic touch. But I think the real crux of answering sort of the big questions about doing this as a single person, practicing chastity, being committed to, among other things, not having sex, is the recognition that there is, in fact, no five-point answer that makes that practice easy and fun-filled. It's a costly practice. It's a difficult discipline. It is a hard piece of the Christian life and of discipleship. And I don't think there's any way around that. When I was writing the book, I interviewed a number of single and or widowed and or divorced people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, including a nun. And not one of them said to me, this has gotten easy, this not having sex thing. Almost all of them said, the fruits of practicing chastity have become more and more evident. Now, that's not exactly the same thing. I actually would rather something be evidently fruitful than easy, but it's not the same thing. And I do think, unfortunately, we carry around this assumption in our church culture that if you're a good Christian, God will reward you with ease and pleasure, And that's not what Jesus says. Jesus heals blind Bartimaeus and says, follow me. And in the next scene, he's heading to Jerusalem to the cross. So where's this newly seeing disciple following him? Not to a bubble bath, but to the Via Dolorosa. He's following him to the cross. So I think in our culture in particular, this is an especially costly and difficult call. And part of being able to practice chastity is to learn and remind ourselves that it may not be easy and it may be costly. Now, I just want to add to that, I've spent a lot of time on Christian college campuses, and I encounter there what I think is a worrying assumption. And the assumption is, I'm suffering as a single person practicing chastity now, and when I get married, it will be easy and great. And you, having heard my little anecdote about my first year of marriage, you will not be surprised to hear me say that actually I think that figuring out what salutary marital sexuality looks like is not that much easier than practicing chastity outside of marriage. In some ways it's easier, right? You do get to have sex. That's a nice thing most of the time. But I think there are challenges to practicing chastity, for married people and for non-married people, as the statistics on Christians committing adultery surely attest.
Here's a little bit of a long question, but I think it's good. It says, one of the fundamental ideas that's conveyed in several Christian sex guides is that in order for a married couple to have good sex, each partner should be committed to their own individual pleasure, whatever it takes, masturbation, fantasies, etc. The idea is that if you are responsible for your own pleasure, you take the pressure off and you both are free to have better sex. This idea just seems wrong to me because I would imagine that you are to serve and love one another first, not yourself first. But I can't figure out an alternative to this. What do you think about it?
Well, I agree with the person who wrote that question that that's a contorted model, that you should just be principally devoted to your own pleasure. That said, I don't think that the only choice is saying that sex is only a selfless and other-directed act. It is, in part, a selfless and other-directed act, but it's also an act that hopefully, people enjoy. And if the sexual revolution has actually taught us anything true about sex, among other things, it's taught us that women actually, should have sexual enjoyment too. and that's a good thing for us to all know. It's interesting. I interviewed a pastor about the question of masturbation. I interviewed several people about that question when I was writing the book, because I actually, in writing the book, came to a much more conservative place on masturbation than I thought initially when I started writing the book. I interviewed one pastor, something very interesting. He said that, in general, he doesn't think masturbation is great for people, but that sometimes in a marriage, maybe particularly at the beginning of a marriage, a woman in particular may need to spend some time masturbating because the woman simply may not really know her body very well and may not understand what does feel good and what is pleasurable. So I thought that was helpful to hear some judicious, yes, there is some space for learning about your body. You don't have to do all of your learning about your body with your spouse right there next to you. That said, it would seem to me that ideally you learn about your body to tell something to your spouse and vice versa. I just don't know that we need to have these extremes of do anything that gives you pleasure or just be completely other directed. I will say I'm sounding sort of more conservative than I think people think I am, but I've been shocked by the number of Christian couples I've met who tell me that they use porn in their marriage. I find there to be nothing redeeming about pornography. It seems to me so destructive and so objectifying and so problematic and so gross and so living in la-la land on so many levels that I hate to sound legalistic, but I just see no circumstance in which that would be the most fruitful response to a sexual challenge in someone's marriage. Do you have comments on any of these questions? I hope you'll chime in and give them.
I was wincing in your agreement with that. It is gross. It's gross. I agree.
But, you know, let's acknowledge that there are many women as well as men who struggle with it. And I will say, if you are struggling with it, porn, come talk to one of your women's ministry mentors. Yeah. So I really do think the lessons that pornography, man, I can go on and on about the lessons I learned from having premarital sex, and they were not good. They were false lessons. They gave me a false picture of what sex is supposed to be like. And they're taking a long time to unlearn. But porn also teaches us some very contorted lessons about what sex is. Principally, that there's not another person. And that it's supposed to, you know, sexual pleasure should just always happen on your own terms. Which is very much at odds with any picture of marital sexuality, which never happens only on your own terms, right? It always involves another person who might have just had a parent die, or who might have had a lousy work week and may not really want to be having sex right then.
Yeah, that's good to hear those answers. And certainly women, I mean, those are some things that come up in our churches, so counseling situations specifically. Okay, here's one that is another topic. Can you be specific or further explain how you can bring situations like grief, like you had with your mom, or problems with children, and how can that be integrated with your sexuality?
Well, I don't mean that you should, like, necessarily start talking about how your child's doing in school, like, while you're in the middle of having sex with your husband. But I do mean that one ought not pretend, okay, it's 10:05 on Tuesday night, and this is our sex night, and so let me just bracket whatever's really going on in our lives, in the rest of our lives. So one thing that might happen is, A, sometimes you have some sex that's just not that great. And it's not that great because you find in the middle of it that, you know, you're not wholly present to it. That's okay. Now, I do want to say very clearly that I do not believe that getting married is consent to sex. You know, people should also absolutely, and this is the second part, be free to say, I don't want to have sex right now. I can't have sex right now. So part of our sex life is about the moments, seasons, whether they're an hour long or a week long or a month long or whatever, in which sex isn't in the cards because you are experiencing grief or you did have this horrible, horrible week, you know, with your child's school. I come back to the idea of getting the picture of your kids, out of your bedroom as so weird because you know, children do, among other aspects of daily life, do really change sexuality. And the question is, do we think that good sex is never interrupted by your five-year-old who just threw up and needs the sheets changed? Now, I would say that if in a marriage every single act of sex is interrupted by a vomiting five-year-old, that's not a great situation. But that actually, in the big arc of domestic sexuality, yeah, actually that's part of good sex. Occasionally it's going to be interrupted by the reminder of what you're doing, who just threw up in his bed and needs his sheets changed. And that, you know, is that sexy? Is that erotic? Well, not according to Hollywood, but it's real life. It's allowing one's sexual life to be infiltrated by the rest of one's domestic goings-on, which again, sometimes you ought to send the vomiting five-year-old to your parents and, you know, go to Tahiti for a week. That's fine, too. But I think many of us are, frankly, made to feel like failures because our sexual desires, our sexual life doesn't live up to this model of always erotic, always swinging from the chandeliers, always novel all the time. I think we ought to allow sex to be routine to some extent. Now, some of us may be wincing, like, oh my gosh, the last thing we should allow sex to be is routine. But I want to suggest that wince is part of the problem. And that prior to the sexual revolution, you know, go call up your great-grandmother in heaven and ask her or your great-grandfather what their definition of good sex is. And they would have given, I think, a very different definition than most people on the street today.
Okay, this is another twist. How do you talk in a truthful, culturally savvy way to a granddaughter about why she should abstain from sex that doesn't sound preachy?
Well, I suppose it depends on how old the granddaughter is. I'll say two things that are really one thing. I do find that personal narrative is real important for people in the whole of Christian life, but particularly in thinking about sexuality. So I think hearing someone else's story is often more compelling. I mean, let me back up. Practicing chastity as a culture is, among other things, about reconfiguring our imaginations. Our imaginations have been formed by so much falsehood about sex. And I don't think we successfully reform people's imaginations by handing them a list of rules. I think part of the way we recapture and reform people's imaginations is by storytelling. So I think it would actually be very powerful for a grandmother to do some storytelling on these questions. Now, a lot of us, maybe moms even more than grandmoms, get very freaked out about actually telling our children that we did something that we're telling them not to do. Now, I'm not an expert in child psychology, and I'm not suggesting you sit down with your 7-year-old and like regale them with all of your, you know, sinful past or what have you. But I do think that narrated in a faithful way, there are times in a relationship to do some of that. We can't just narrate out of our experiences of being perfect Christians, because none of us is. We have to also do some narrating out of our lived experiences of the consequence of sin. I want to add to that it, of course, it's not always the mother or grandmother who ought to necessarily be doing that narrating necessarily to their child or grandchild. My mother, for a few years in the 1960s, was a middle school guidance counselor. And she always told the parents of her students, the most important thing you can do for your child at this age is to get them in intentional relationships with adults who share your values who are not you. And I just think that's completely true for middle schoolers. It's true for all of us, but it is true for teens and tweens and whatever else you are at that age, a teen and a tween. And that's a call not only, of course, for parents to help facilitate those relationships, it's a call for the rest of us, like me, who doesn't have children, to actually go be that other adult who shares the values of a friend of mine with children. Yeah. That did sound unmiked.
Yeah, it does. I'm streaming.
There you go.
There we go.
So being in those relationships, and finally, I do think that this is another piece of community, personal authority actually carries a lot of weight when it's coming from the context of a meaningful relationship. You know, so if one is you know, getting to know a teenager in the church that you've known for like 3 weeks, that probably may not be the time to have the sex talk with that teenager yet, right? I mean, this perhaps goes without saying. But I think the more time we log with one another, having ordinary relationships with each other, the better able we are then to have these hard, intimate conversations. And on some level, we don't like to hear that, because logging ordinary time with people doesn't sound exciting, and it does take time. We live in a highly mobile society, and if you don't stay put in one place, it's hard to form those relationships with people. But I think that ordinary time with one another is in part what allows us to have those conversations.
Okay, this one is a good one, I think, to expound on, like you do so well. How do you cast off the premarital feeling of being used in sex when you're now married, especially feeling like need to measure up to the media's portrayal of how you are to be good in bed? Look at it a little bit better.
I'm not sure I totally understand this question. So I'm going to change it a little bit. And instead of just addressing the question of how do you cast off the premarital feeling of being used in sex, I think there are a variety of feelings that people might bring to marriage, from premarital sexual encounters. And incidentally, a premarital sexual encounter doesn't necessarily just mean having sex, right? You might have had some encounter that wasn't actually sex that still, you know, leaves you with certain feelings. I will say a couple of things about this. First of all, I think patience and generosity with oneself, not thinking that this is going to happen overnight. You know, again, I think the lessons we learn from engaging in sexual sin do stick with us for a while. So some patience with that. I also find in my own life and in counseling with other women that it can be, you may have a perfectly wonderful relationship with your spouse and you may have great communication, and talking about sexual difficulty may just be where the great communication breaks down, and where it just, you think you can talk with your spouse about anything and it just becomes so hard to talk about your own feelings of sexual frustration or failure or whatever the source of those feelings. And for that reason, I think it is really important to not always try to have those conversations alone, just you and your spouse staring at each other, feeling ashamed, annoyed, and frustrated. But to have someone in the church, doesn't have to necessarily be your pastor, but a trusted, wise friend with whom you can go have these conversations about the most embarrassing, difficult things. And I think that applies to single life as well. I mean, people sometimes ask me, right, the line drawing question, where should I, what can I do with my boyfriend sexually? Where do I draw the line? I think that's actually not the best way of framing the question for a lot of reasons. But one thing I often say to people is, wherever you draw the line, don't make that decision by yourself. Go sit with your boyfriend and some trusted person from the church and have them give you some guidelines and help you make that decision. And that's helpful not only because we tend to be people of self-deceit about a lot of issues, but particularly, like, if you want to see yourself be self-deceiving, go hang out with your boyfriend at 2 a.m. in the dark, and you will begin to deceive yourself about what is good for you to do. So another person can puncture that tendency to self-deceit. But I think this is about establishing habits of being willing to talk about sex with other people. And if one does eventually get married, having established those habits of it being okay to talk with someone else, not just the object of your affections, about your sexual choices and your sexual state is real helpful. It's just very hard for married couples to, like, figure this stuff out behind closed doors. And God is obviously present to us when we're just figuring it out behind closed doors, but I think that God can be particularly present to us through the ministry of a sibling in Christ.
Yeah, the sibling. Could you explain that real briefly again, what you mean by sibling in Christ? A sibling?
A brother or sister in Christ, a fellow Christian whom is known to you and whom you know.
Just in case there's some confusion. Thank you, dear. Listen with this one. If there is one thing that you would like to see churches do differently, what would it be?
Well, you already know the answer because I said that this afternoon.
I
would like to see churches, I assume you mean do differently about sex, because,
yes.
You know, I could have some other answers. I think that we unfortunately tend to, when we talk about sex, we just isolate it. I mean, I did it tonight. I'm guilty of this tonight. We just isolate sex, and when we talk about sex, that's all we're talking about. So we do the sex lecture or the, you know, 6-week study on sex, or we do, among other things, that I had premarital sex that I sometimes enjoyed. Well, why did I enjoy it? I enjoyed it not because it was in fact good for me, not because it was in fact a good thing to do, but because I am so distorted by sinfulness and by my fallenness that sometimes things that are lousy feel good, and sometimes things that are good feel lousy. So, in other words, connecting a teaching about, say, the effects of sexual sin to a more basic Christian teaching about, like, well, what is sin? And how does sin work in our lives? And isn't it the case that the way that sin works in our lives is to lie to us? And to tell us that stuff is that's bad for us, that estranges us from God and estranges us from our neighbor, actually feels great. How does sin work? Where do we see discussions of how sin works in the scriptures? What are some other areas of life, not sex areas, but how we interact with money or how we interact with our families or how we interact with our friends or how we view our work life, where similar kinds of sin manifest themselves. So I think we isolate sex because sex makes us nervous and because sex is a huge deal. But I actually suspect that a truer and more helpful way of thinking about sex as a community would be to connect sex to these other areas of human life and to other sort of basic Christian claims. And that's because at the end of the day, I'm not like first and foremost concerned about what you're doing with your sexuality. I'm foremost concerned about what you're doing with God. And you ought to be foremost concerned about what I'm doing with God. And then from that come some thoughts and hopes and expectations about what we do as sexual beings and what we do as embodied beings. But those hopes and concerns and expectations need to always be reconnected to the fundamental. And the fundamental is this is part of God's good vision for us, and it's part of how we have a good relationship with Him and how we have a good relationship with one another. When we lose that context, then I think we're in danger of just being moralists and just being legalists. And not actually being proclaimers of the gospel and bearers of the kingdom in the world.